Alas, we're into the thick of it. Summer, that is. For some, this means a time for fishing, from a pier or a boat, on a pond, or out at sea. Yet for one woman in a seaside community, fishing season is year-round as she practices a 2,000-year-old art form. Then, we'll turn to a scientist author who searches all realms to tackle some big questions, and it doesn't matter if it's summer, spring, winter, or fall. Also on this week's 51%, we'll take a look at a female first for the U.S. Navy. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade.
Gyutaku is the Japanese art of making prints by applying inks to dead fish and then rubbing them with silks, and it's thought to have originated in the fish markets. These prints were a simple way to convey the fish of the day. There's also a legend that a Japanese emperor wanted to preserve the image of a beautiful fish he caught before serving it at a banquet, so he devised this art form as a way to forever keep an image of his fish. Well, Jenny Bovey and her husband have been making these one-of-a-kind prints for more than 25 years. She's one of the few full-time practitioners of the 2,000-year-old Japanese art form on Main Street in the seaside community of Chatham, Massachusetts. Kara Janesco reports.
26 years ago, Jenny Bovey worked long hours as an executive in training at Macy's. One night, she and the date that would become her husband went to an art opening. That's when she spotted it.
There was this tiny little rubbing, or I didn't identify it as a rubbing. It was an image of a fish. It was positioned right next to the bathroom door, and it just bit me in the butt. There is no other way to describe it, and I had no idea what I was looking at. All I knew is that it resonated. It really, really, really captured me.
She spent the entire evening trying to figure out what it was, and the next day and the next. She called the aquarium, art schools, museums, until finally someone identified it as a fish rubbing, the Japanese art called gyutaku. She'd found her calling.
I'm a professional dead fish printer. That is a professional dead fish printer.
That's right. Jenny's like the Da Vinci of dead fish. Here's how she does it.
I paint the specimen, press it directly onto the surface area, and then peel it back, and the result is a one-of-a-kind print.
Starting out, Jenny'd be on the docks at 4 a.m. to cull through fish markets for interesting specimens. She called friends like the Chatham Shellfish Constable, who sent her a codfish in the mail. Soon, she didn't have to look for the fish. They just started to fall into her lap. Fishermen brought dripping bluefish and buckets of fluttery skates to her front door.
Another friend called me up and told me that he had this in his nets. This is a sandbar tiger shark, otherwise known as a ragged tooth shark. And, you know, we barter. This one cost me 4 cases of beer.
For the shark, she used graphic black ink on Egyptian papyrus. The result looks almost like a cave painting. But she started out on a smaller scale.
Our first fish that we ever did was a black sea bass, and that's what this is. It was one of the first fish that I ever caught as a kid. It has a very big scale, feathery fins. It has a combination of earth tones and iridescence and jewel tones. It's a really beautiful fish.
This is Jenny's favorite palette to work with, earth tones and jewel tones. What she uses depends on how well the ink will sink into the skin of the specimen and how well it transfers to the silk or rice paper or t-shirt she presses into it. Bold wild fish make for bold wild prints. Take the sea robin.
The sea robin is the closest thing to a dinosaur I've ever seen, or a dragon. Okay, it's the closest thing to a dragon. I put it on this one on Chinese Banner Red because of that. And I love the way they move. They swim like they're almost a hovercraft. But I have a dead one over here.
Jenny has 6 fridges, all filled with dead fish, some preserved and reused for over 20 years. Yes, 20 years. I asked her what her teenage boys think, and she said they're pretty used to it. They grew up in the studio. Fish rubbing isn't a hobby. It's her family's business. When they were born, 2 kids in 2 years, she says it was one of the most challenging times in her life. She'd have to print with a kid strapped into a baby backpack, or if need be, in the middle of the night.
They just knew when I wasn't there. I mean, I'm creeping down the stairs, you know, trying to get down into the studio, and we're It was very challenging.
Did you ever have a moment going down the stairs and hearing the kids cry and knowing you got to go to the studio where you thought, maybe it's time to go back to Macy's, or maybe I don't know if I can make this work?
You know, no. I had something happen to me just last week. There was a house that was for sale, and I was being brought through it just with a friend. And I look in the bathroom, and I go, that's cool. Oh, my God, that's mine. The grab was still there. Like, it still kind of bit me in the butt. You know?
It's pretty clear. Jenny Bovey's love of dead fish is very much alive. In Chatham, Massachusetts, this is Kara Janesco.
This is a black sea bass.
Jenny Bovey and her husband Andrew run Blue Water Fish Rubbings on Main Street in Chatham, Massachusetts. Each handmade Gyutaku print comes from a real fish. Educated as a scientist, Barbara Ehrenreich is an award-winning and best-selling author, journalist, activist, and advocate for social justice. Her new book, Living with a Wild God, A Non-Believer's Search for the Truth About Everything, is her first memoir. She recounts her quest, beginning in childhood, to find the truth about the universe and everything else. The book tackles the big questions that we face in a highly personal manner. 51%'s Joe Donahue speaks with Ehrenreich about her quest.
Give us a sense of at what point you thought, I'd like to write about myself, I'd like to write a memoir.
Well, I actually had in mind originally to write a history of religion. Pretty ambitious project, but I had some ideas and wanted to do that. And a lot of what my research for that informs this book in ways that you probably wouldn't notice, because the book turned out to be a narrative. I decided to build my story around my own experiences and put these sort of theory parts into what is a narrative, an action-packed narrative, I dare say, of my early years, up to about the age of 30.
You certainly write an awful lot about your adolescence and childhood. You speak very frankly about your family. Is that difficult to reveal, or does it just give a context, do you think?
Well, I didn't intend to be revealing any great secrets. This is not a story of abuse, or, well, there's some things that I would call abuse now as a modern parent and grandparent, but we're not at the time. My parents married too young. They had me too young. They were originally quite poor. Let's get right to it. There was a lot of drinking in the family.
Right. And it was not a religious family.
No, no. And that was one of, I think, something I'm very grateful for. My parents, you know, came from Butte, Montana, a copper mining town. My father had been a miner, as were most of the men in the family who weren't railroad workers. And they were very, dare I say, intellectual. They read a lot. Mm-hmm. They discussed a lot. My father was adamantly an atheist. So was my mother. And that tradition goes back a few generations earlier to an Irish Catholic. I don't know if she's great-great-grandmother or great-great-great-grandmother, who lived in western Montana in the 1880s. And rejected the church completely, because when her father lay dying and she sent for the priest to administer last rites, she got back a message saying she'd have to pay $25, a huge sum.
Absolutely.
For those people. And that was the end for my family.
you kept a journal in your adolescence, which you discovered, which I assume in some ways informs much of the book and writing about those early years.
Yes, it was something to build on. It was a primary source for my research. I couldn't have done this book wouldn't have thought of doing it if I didn't have that journal. I couldn't just publish the journal. I mean, things that you write when you're 14 are not necessarily the way you'd write them when you're a little bit older, like 50 years older. And also, I think the journal was frustratingly evasive at times. It was entirely about my philosophical adventures and my efforts to find the truth about everything. And it gets a little tangled. So I had to do a lot of deconstructing, reconstructing, to get the story out.
And for you, the story is, because I'm curious at that age how much you were thinking, as you say, in philosophical terms, but were you thinking about religion? Were you thinking about the things that were not part of your life, of what was out there, of what was creating things?
Oh, yes, I thought a lot about religion. Most of my friends when I was a kid were Catholics or Protestants, and some of them tried to convert me. I went to services with some of them. I was not impressed or won over by their churches. But I was kind of fascinated. You know, here were people all around me who believed in something, who believed that there was a single God, a unique God who runs everything and also happens to be intensely interested in each one of us. I thought this was a fascinating delusion.
And you explore life and death and mortality. They're all very deep subjects to be considering at that age.
I don't know if they are deep subjects to be considering at that age. I think these are very common subjects for young people, adolescents especially. We're just encouraged to put them aside and mature and grow up and face, you know, important issues like how to pay our student debts and our mortgage if we have one and so on. But they never went away from me, the questions.
So with that said, are you more conscious of how your childhood shaped the path that you took as an adult?
I'm not sure. I don't really try to connect all the dots and say, this is the cause of that, and which leads to that, or anything. My life doesn't seem to proceed that way. There are sudden surprises. Now, I think that there are some things that go back to childhood. Certainly, I remain an atheist, but also a kind of social consciousness. Since my culture of origin was a blue-collar culture, you know, I was taught really to respect everybody's work, that everybody was working very, very hard to make my life and other people's lives possible. And that certainly continues with me.
Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest. The title of the new book is Living with a Wild God. Describe the wild God you were living with.
Huh. Well, first, here's a little of the history of religion part of this, that monotheism is a pretty recent innovation. It's only about 2,500 years old. And I was very impressed to learn that most religions before that, if you can even call them religions, centered on deities who were not human-shaped, who were multiple, who were female, and were often in the form of animals. My own ancestors, my Celtic ancestors, worshipped a goddess, Epona, who took the shape of a horse. she's not, you know, these gods were not good, they were not bad, they were not particularly interested in us, but these were the centers of religion. So I use God in a pretty generous ecumenical fashion here, way beyond monotheism.
And as far as the wild part, for you, there was a relationship.
Well, and it's how I would describe a God who is not good, who is has its own agenda, who may not even be singular, may be plural. They're a consciousness other than our own that exists in the universe, and can sometimes interact with.
You're hard in the book on both religion and science, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on how those two can and should or should not coexist.
Oh, I don't think they can be exactly reconciled. I bring a rationalist scientific perspective to things that other people would simply say are, you know, the jurisdiction of religion or mysticism. I say, no, so people have these mystical experiences, strange experiences, which I certainly did in my teenage years. I don't, you know, put that off in a separate box and say, well, that's just the mysterious, unknowable, et cetera. I say, no, I want to understand what that's about. And so the last third of the book comes into my middle years and older years, and the attempts to figure that out.
The mystical experience that you had in adolescence, as you write about, had to have been shattering, given that quest to find out what is real and what the truth is.
Well, yes, and I couldn't put it into words. I was 17 years old. I had what seemed to me to be an encounter with something alive, and I would say conscious. But I had, you know, no words for that. I had no idea what to do with that information, with that experience, and decided very rationally that it must have been a mental breakdown, and kind of put it away like that. Mm-hmm. For decades, all the time sort of secretly in my mind returning to it, and finally in later years saying, well, I think it was an encounter.
Have you ever thought that it could be recreated in a way?
I don't know. I can't. I mean, you mean like with meditation or...
Meaning that if you are open to it, meaning that if you are open to it, and that is that if you sort of understand it more, that it could happen again.
Oh, I think it could happen again. I don't know. I have any idea of what would make it happen again. Why would you want to make it happen again, though?
Right.
I mean, it was both ecstatic and shattering. So there was that, there was an allure, but I would not go looking for something like that.
When you talk about the experience of writing the book, do you feel that going over your adolescence, reading that journal from those years, does that change you in a significant way?
Yes, I learned a lot. I forced myself to think through a lot of hard things. I did research. yeah, I felt this is something I had to do. I felt I had to do, and that I, you know, if I didn't eventually do it, you know, I'd run out of time, and I couldn't do it.
That was 51%'s Joe Donahue speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. All around the country, summer reading lists will feature familiar authors of the literary canon. In recent decades, that canon has come to include a small group of Black writers. One scholar argues that it's time to expand that group, starting with the addition of Harlem writer Ann Petrie. Allison Quantz has the story.
High schoolers today could probably name the same handful of classic African-American authors. Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, Zora Neale Hurston. One name they probably couldn't give you is Ann Petrie.
So many people have not heard of such a productive writer.
This is Keith Clark, a literary scholar at George Mason University. He says that 65 years ago, people would have known Petrie's name.
The book The Street, her main novel, was so popular in 1945 that Ed Sullivan mentioned her novel in his column. And she was also featured in Ebony Magazine, which was a leading periodical for decades. The attention she got was just colossal.
Petrie was widely popular with Black and white audiences. The Street, that first big novel, was about a Black single mother in Harlem. But her second novel focused on a white community. There was backlash from critics who argued she was abandoning the issue of race.
If you were an African-American writer in the 30s, 40s, 50s, you were supposed to write so-called protest literature. You were supposed to write about the race problem.
Way ahead of her time, Petrie argued that she was dealing with race, with whiteness.
People so often think when they think race, they immediately go to Black. And so what Petrie was saying very clearly and very ardently is that I'm going to put white people under the microscope.
Petrie also spoke openly about what was expected of her as a female writer. In the 80s, she wrote about one encounter with a reporter who asked, "What does your husband do?" She looked the reporter dead in the eyes and said,
"If I were a man, would you ask me what my wife did?" And so she was pointing out the critical gender double standard. And so Petrie was really someone who let her opinions be known. But again, she would do it very quickly and very, you know, almost with a scalpel. And then she'd move on.
Just as Petrie could speak to womanhood, Clark says she also had a complex understanding of masculinity, particularly Black masculinity.
The point that she was making in the 1940s about how African-American men are demonized in this culture, for example, it is still reverberating in the year 2014.
Clark argues that Petrie deserves a spot in the literary canon, not only for her striking representations of earlier eras, but also because of her insight into issues that just don't seem to disappear. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quantz.
On my first show, you heard about a female first at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. President Obama, during his graduation speech, pointed out that the year marked the Service Academy's first all-female command team. Well, graduation has come and gone, and West Point was expected to welcome a record-high number of women in the incoming class. West Point officials have been taking steps to boost the number of women at the academy, in part to prepare for when the Army opens thousands of combat positions to both sexes by 2016. West Point officials say the 263 women represent 22% of the 1,200 cadet candidates who were expected to arrive at the beginning of July for reception day. Females had made up 16% of all West Point cadets this past spring. And West Point Director of Admissions Colonel Deborah McDonald says the class of 2018 also includes a record number of minorities. And there's a female first in the Navy, the first female four-star admiral. She is Michelle Janine Howard, who was recently promoted to the service's highest rank. The ceremony was held at the Women in Military Service for America Memorial at the Arlington National Cemetery near the Pentagon. She will serve as the Vice Chief of Naval Operations, which makes her the number two admiral in the Navy. Howard has served 32 years in the Navy. She is a 1978 graduate of Gateway High School in Aurora, Colorado. She graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1982, and among her many distinctions, Howard in 1999 became the first African-American woman to command a Navy ship. And as we hearken back to West Point's graduation, during my first show, you heard from Cheryl Lee Ralph, one of the graduate stepmothers, as she celebrated the first mentioned by President Obama. She said it then, and I see no reason not to resurrect her comment in this instance.
Females, yes!
After all, it is a recurring theme here. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Chartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1303.